Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Last week, The Wall Street Journal's Drew Hinshaw saw his friend Evan for the first time since March. It was only on video, and Evan was in a glass box, pacing, because the Russian government has detained him.
It's the first glimpse of Evan Gershkovich for weeks. The U.S. reporter.
By now, you've probably heard Evan Gershkovich's name. The journalist is accused of espionage. He faces 20 years in prison. The Moscow courthouse, where he appeared, it was packed.
A few journalists call out their support. Hold strong, one shouts. Everyone sends you a big hello, the voice says. Before being hustled away.
Drew has been assigned to cover his friend's story for the publication they both work for.
How you doing?
Yeah, I'm okay.
Yeah, what a weird time for you.
Totally. It is weird. It's surreal. It is, this is the first time Russia has brought a spy case against an overseas reporter since the Cold War.
And as Evan's colleague and friend, I assume you would say there's no truth to these allegations.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Not just me, by the way. I mean, that's what the Wall Street Journal says. That's what his friends and family says. And the State Department has declared him a wrongfully detained American and said that these charges are bogus. So that's coming from a lot of different corners.
Do you think the truth matters here?
What I can say is that in the Russian system, espionage trials are conducted in secret and they almost always end in a conviction.
The uncanny thing about watching Evan in court, for Drew, was seeing these little flashes of the reporter he's so familiar with. His arms were folded in front of him, as if he couldn't quite believe where he'd found himself.
He's someone who lives and breathes this job. And what stood out to me is I could see the smile on his face when he saw his colleagues in that room. Those people covering him, for another American detained in Russia, that probably would have been very discombobulating. Here's these journalists with their cameras pointed at you. For Evan, these are his colleagues, and beyond colleagues, they're his friends.
Drew says it's not that Evan didn't know his work was risky. He did.
I mean, he once tweeted something that I think summed it up. He once tweeted, "Reporting in Russia is now also a regular practice of watching people you know get locked away for years." And Evan was doing the honorable thing, the right thing, and trying to report that and understand what was happening in Russia. And I think this is among other things, really indicative of just where the U.S.-Russia relationship is at the moment. And it's about the right for fair and accurate and balanced reporting.
It sounds like you'd say there's the U.S.-Russia relationship before this detention and after it. Like it's sort of a line in the sand.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting thought. It's definitely, for a lot of Western news agencies, it certainly is. A lot of, Western news outlets that posted reporters to Moscow under Joseph Stalin have determined that under President Vladimir Putin, Russia is just too dangerous for journalism.
Today on the show, how Evan Gershkovich found himself in the middle of the fight over press freedom in Russia. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around.
This episode is brought to you by Discover.
When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
How did you first meet Evan?
So he joined the journal about a year ago, and he'd been living and working in Russia for about 6 years.
Were you there too, or were you just a European correspondent, so you knew?
So I cover Central and Eastern Europe, which is so interesting because I was on the other side of this, you know, really very serious political divide between Russia on the east and then, you know, Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, countries that just really, frankly, would love to have a, you know, 2-mile-high wall between them and this country.
So did you, like, reach out to him on Slack the first day, like, hey, from across the way?
Well, Evan and I met in London. And, I mean, we chatted for hours. Several times I've kind of closed out the bar with him, not because the bar was interesting, but because he is, because his reporting is interesting. And yeah, so he's my experience of him was he's really energetic and enthusiastic and just has this sort of buoyant energy about him. When he goes to press conferences in Russia, he's kind of known for like addressing politicians in informal Russian, you know, like guys who are used to be called, you know, very formally and, you know, in this serious kind of, you know, bureaucratic language. And he rocks up in like New Balance sneakers and like an old gray sweater and addresses them in the kind of informal Russian that he uses with his family. It's off-putting and charming and also just kind of, it really has worked for him in terms of being someone that can understand the country that he's in somehow.
How much do you know about Evan's personal story? Like how he came to be a journalist and his parents' immigration to the U.S.? Because they came from Russia, right?
That's right. Well, his parents have their own very interesting story. They don't like to be called survivors because they will tell you that they found this optimism in America when they left the Soviet Union and they took it on. But their parents have really their life kind of traces this tragedy of both Russia and Ukraine.
They're Jewish, right?
They're Jewish, yeah. And his grandmother survived the Holocaust. She was a nurse in a Polish military hospital at the end of the war. She treated some of these patients coming in from Auschwitz. These were patients who, you know, who couldn't eat very much. They had to fight the kind of human urge to eat because if they ate too much, their bodies couldn't handle it. And when she would recall that story, she would weep.
His mother has told the story about how her family would put blankets over the windows when they lit candles for the Sabbath.
That's right. She was afraid as a teenager. She's afraid to go into a synagogue because they were afraid that if you did, you would be photographed and, you know, the Secret Service would take note of you.
It's interesting that they raised Evan with this desire to go back to Russia.
They tell this story that they took him back to Russia on a visit, I think in the 90s, you know, and they went to the very synagogue that I just mentioned, and they went to a museum about Jewish life. And they said to him afterwards, like, now I think you can understand us, because it was this moment when, you know, it's hard to imagine as a boy growing up in New Jersey, this kind of experience. They left in the 70s when there were rumors going about that Soviet Jews were about to be deported to Siberia. You know, for Evan's mother, her mother had survived this. I mean, that you can imagine just how important it was for them to get out and then to make their way to the U.S.
So why was returning to Russia a goal for Evan?
So I've been kind of talking to his colleagues and friends, and you know, there's an interesting person in this who is a role model for, I think, a lot of people of like me and Evan's generation of foreign correspondents, and that's like Anthony Bourdain. He loved Anthony Bourdain. When he worked in kitchens in New York City, he was a line cook.
Yeah, he did that while he was working for the New York Times, right?
That's right. That's right. And he would leave work and go to a club or a bar or something with friends, and he would have seven knives, seven kitchen knives, to be clear, on his person.
Because
he loved cooking. And everybody who you talked about, Evan, says he's an amazing chef. He absolutely loves food, And he has that Anthony Bourdain spirit of I want to go and understand the other parts of the world. Okay, so he was working at the New York Times, which for a lot of people, at that point would be a dream job, right? I mean, he was a news assistant, but, you work your way up. But someone said to him, look, you've got Russian language skills. You understand the country on some level because of your parents. You should go back and freelance, which for a lot of people would be a little bit intimidating, Where do you start? How do you begin? And he did it. He made the leap. And I think he was actually very successful very relatively quickly.
Evan joined the Journal just weeks before Russia invaded Ukraine. Can you describe that time?
Yeah, absolutely. So when Evan joined in January and February, the prediction coming out of the Pentagon was that this would be a very kind of swift victory for Russia. There was not just in the Pentagon, there was a fatalism across Europe.
Yeah, the thought was just like tanks rolling into Kyiv.
That's right. That's right. And one of his first stories was from the border of Belarus, where he just watched these, a string of Russian military ambulances with their windows blocked with gray shades pulling up to a main hospital, just across the border, basically bringing in casualties from the front. And I remember reading it and thinking one of the first signs that, this is actually not for Russia. This is actually not looking very good for them, is it? This kind of swift march into Kyiv wasn't at all panning out.
Evan left Russia soon after the invasion, along with many members of the Western press. But he still wanted to understand how regular Russian citizens were making sense of their sanctioned existence. So he decided to go back. He wrote stories only someone on the ground could, like this detailed report on the return of clubbing and jazz festivals among Moscow's young people. They were dancing and drinking as the war raged on. But even as Muscovites seemed to ignore the largest ground invasion in Europe since World War II, the city was becoming more hostile to Westerners like Evan.
He kind of liked to go to the sauna and chat there. And he goes to the sauna near the end of 2022, and another bather kind of heard him speaking in English and basically, told him with some pretty heavy and awful expletives to stop speaking English. And, he thought for a minute and then just sort of shot back, Russia is a multilingual country. And the guy paused for a second, then he said back, but English isn't one of them.
Drew told me why, despite this aggression, this anxiety, Evan still wanted to report on Russia from Russia.
It's because of Evan and a fairly small number of reporters that we know what's going on in this part of the world.
What kind of precautions did he have to take?
He reported some strange incidents. One incident, he was followed by several Russian security officers, some of whom recorded his movements with a camera. He assumed his phone was monitored. And there was another trip to the western region of Pskov, where he was sort of followed and filmed by unidentified men. So I think you can, derive from that, that was there in the atmosphere.
After the break, Evan's damning reporting on Putin and the harrowing Russian prison he's now being held in.
Thank you. If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
I know you worked with Evan on this extensive piece about Vladimir Putin back in December. I wonder if we can talk about that experience and the experience of working closely with him and also reporting on something that certainly is not going to make his life easier as a correspondent inside Russia.
So towards the end of last year, it's pretty clear that the journal owed its readers, you know, some sort of a profile of who Putin has become and where his head is at. And not only us. The New York Times, around the same time, did a profile of Putin. And, I mean, they had quite literally 25 reporters working on it. And I know that number because Evan counted the, you know, so-and-so contributed to this, so-and-so contributed to this, so-and-so contributed to this. We had Evan. And I have to say, Evan held his own. He evened the score, I think, for being one reporter up against, you know, a whole army of, you know, competing journalists. Evan was able to, you know, sort of build a profile that showed the president was sort of isolated and surrounded by kind of a handful of hardline advisors who were telling him things were going better than they really were.
Yeah. How did you find out that Evan had been arrested?
I was eating dinner with a fellow reporter who works closely with Evan, as do I, but, you know, he had been kind of in contact with him early that day. And when he had texted him back, you know, he had texted him that morning and said, hey, you know, good luck today, because he knew he was out, you know, reporting. And Evan had texted back, you know, thanks, I'll let you know how it goes. And when he didn't respond to, like, a later text, my colleague I was meeting for dinner got a bit nervous and worried, as understandably so. So the newsroom kind of scrambled to, you know, reach people in Yekaterinburg, where he had been. And what kind of, you know, we didn't know. We're sort of sitting there trying to figure this out. And then there was a vague post on the messaging service Telegram reporting that security agents had taken someone from a steakhouse in Yekaterinburg with his hood up. And it didn't say that person was Evan, but somehow there was a feeling in your stomach that this could be him.
I'm imagining you guys at some restaurant, both with your cell phones out, tapping and tapping and tapping as you realized what was going on. Is that what it was like?
Yeah, and just a bit. I mean, on a personal level, I felt like I was in a fever that night. It's hard to sleep. You know, you kind of like my limbs quite literally felt like hot. Like I felt like I had almost like a fever, just kind of being unable to sleep, thinking about at that moment, you know, where is he?
I know you've reported on the prison where Evan's being detained. Can you tell me more about that place?
Yeah, he's in Lefortovo prison. It's a Tsarist era prison, but it's really famous from the Stalin era, when the executions of purged officials would take place in the basement.
So it has a history.
Absolutely. These days, it's kind of most famous for its isolation. It's a prison where you can, you know, spend a very long time without ever seeing another prisoner or even hearing another prisoner.
Everyone's in solitary?
Everyone is in solitary. No, at some point, you might be given a cellmate. But if you're given a cellmate, that's the only other person except for a prison warden that you would see. Hmm. Trevor Reed, who was a U.S. Marine Corps veteran, who was in six prisons in Russia, described it as the most sinister. You just couldn't hear or see anyone. When they move you in the prison, what they do is they clink metal together, either their keys or they have these, like, they snap their fingers sometimes. And that basically what that does is warn all the other prison guards, if there are any prisoners in the hallway, put them away now. Because the idea is when you're being escorted from your cell to be interrogated, you should not see any other prisoner. You should be isolated. Totally, totally isolated. Not even a quick glance, like eye contact, that might be kind of fortifying for someone who's in that position.
Wow. I mean, that's a way to break someone down.
Yeah. Yeah.
How many journalists like Evan are left in Russia? Like Americans reporting from inside the country?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know the exact latest toll. But I mean, the Wall Street Journal has pulled its Russia bureau chief out of the country. We're not the only ones. That sort of thin window into what was happening in Russia is really, really closing.
There's been this speculation, and I know you don't want to talk about it in great depth, that Russia might be angling for some kind of prisoner swap here. And many listeners will, of course, remember basketball star Brittany Griner, who was recently freed in exchange for arms dealer Victor Boot. But reading the reporting a little bit, what struck me is that it seems like it's Russia's policy not to trade anyone until they're convicted, which would mean this story could be going on for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He had a bail hearing where he was basically, denied bail. And his, they upheld his detention. And, the Journal had offered up a bail, a pretty considerable bail, and it was rejected. The court rejected that.
How long do you think you're going to be able to continue reporting on your friend?
I mean, as a person, I can't imagine what would make me stop,
Yeah. You want to close the bar down with him again soon, I can tell.
I would love that. Actually, it's funny. He's reading Life and Fate, according to this Russian prison monitor. So if that guy's lying, he owes me a lot of time, because I'm now reading Life and Fate because I thought, well, I should have something to relate with Evan about.
You're reading the same book he's reading. What's Life and Fate?
Okay, but this is the thing. It's like 800 pages long. I didn't know that. I heard, it's a novel about World War II. I thought, all right, 300 pages. I've got time for that. It's 800 pages, Mary. So it's fantastic. It's an amazing book. I can't wait to talk to him about it. I'm sure it must be. I'm like, part of me is like surprised that they let you read that in a Russian prison, because it's incredibly critical of authoritarianism. Yeah, I'm about 100 pages into it. I'm gonna guess he's deeper into the book than I am. But so things like that, it's nice to kind of feel some connection to your colleague, even though he's on the other side of this wall.
You still sound kind of shocked this is all happening.
Yeah, yeah. What makes you say that?
It's just something about your voice. Like,
yeah.
I can hear you processing it in real time.
Yeah. It's hard to imagine. I can't count how many people who've been in Lefortovo prison. And at this point, I have a sense of how the prison works. We got some to go on Google Maps and, basically identify this is where this happens, this is where the interrogations happen. But that's all abstract and it's journalistic. And when you stop to think, this is... somebody that in a normal time I'd be reporting the story with, who's in there. Yeah, it's, it is a bit surreal.
Drew, I'm really grateful for your time and for your reporting. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Drew Hinshaw is a senior world reporter at the Wall Street Journal. And that's the show. If you're a fan of what we're doing here at What Next, the best way to support us, show us a little love, is to join our membership program. It's known as Slate Plus. Go on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to find out all about it. What Next is produced by Elena Schwartz, Anna Phillips, Paige Osborne, Madeline Ducharme, and now Rob Gunther. We're getting a little help from Laura Spencer. We are led by Alicia Montgomery with a little boost from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is our Senior Director of Podcast Operations at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. Go track me down on Twitter. Say hello. I'm at Mary's desk. All right. I'll catch you back here tomorrow.